When we share someone's story here on the Diaries, the episode might end, but their story doesn't. So many of the people we've talked to, they've gone on to do incredible things. They have epic adventures and make significant impacts in our community. Over on Diaries Plus, we're catching up with some of our former guests to see what they've been up to. I recently sat down with Connor Ryan, a Lakota professional skier from our Sacred Slopes episode, who's been knocking out groundbreaking projects ever since the episode aired. It's really incredible. We had a great discussion about the impacts he's made, what keeps his fire burning, and taking ski lessons as a pro skier. Here's a snippet of the conversation.
All the source of joy that I use to fill my cup to be out in the world doing positive things comes from my relationship to the outdoors. And so I've really focused on like, wow, like there's so much power if I can give one person the relationship to the outdoors that I have through skiing. And maybe that will have as profound of an effect on them as it's had on me.
To listen to the full episode, use the link in the show notes to subscribe to Diaries Plus today. Yeah, you get more shows, but you also have a peace of mind of powering what's out there right now, keeping us moving forward, keeping this community together. So thank you for everyone who supported and everyone who's going to support. We appreciate it. I need to have a very serious conversation with y'all. Something needs to change. You do not scare me. For 13 years, every October, you start sending in these stories. They're supposedly scary, right? It's like, really, you expect the hair on my neck to stand up or to have a tough time going to sleep, or that, you know, they're not looping in my head every time I go out running while I'm putting this show together. Come on. That's never happened. You don't scare me. Seriously. Guy that sent in the story about the mysterious hitchhiker who shares all the details of his life while you're driving on a mountain pass, and then you go to visit his place of work and it turns out he's been dead for months. It's a mistaken identity, clearly. Or the one from 10 years ago when the forest crew found the freshly dug grave, and the next day there were two freshly dug graves. Like, come on. That's just somebody getting topsoil for their garden way out in the backcountry. Right? I mean, how is that scary? Come on. And you backcountry skier, right? Who found himself in the stand of trees littered with old child's toys and trinkets hanging from the branches. It's just so basic. It's totally explainable. I mean, that's gotta be some Waldorf school field trip, you know, like some alternative education thing where they get kids out in the woods and they can make cool art projects. And look, it doesn't work. All those times you send me those stories, they just go in one eyeball and out the other with me. I don't ever think about your stories when I'm riding my local trail at 4:30 a.m. on a cold November morning, and I almost run straight into an elderly man with no headlamp who just looked at me and kept walking. I mean, not weird. Don't try to tell me that's weird. I mean, he's probably researching bats 4 miles from the road in November, doesn't wear a headlight because he doesn't want to disturb them, and he can count them because maybe he can... Whew. 13 years you've been doing this to me. Nerves of steel, this guy. Who's afraid? Not me. Not me. Not at all. Did the lights just go out? Becca? Look, this is... It's Becca! Today, we present our annual edition of Tales of Terror. We have three stories for you, and I will not lie. The terror is going to steadily mount. No. I'm not even going to tell you. That's right. Take that, listener. Whew. You have no idea what is about to happen. But that nagging dread, that feeling of terrible horror you're starting to feel, it's all too real. Welcome to the Dirtbag Diaries. I'm Fitzko Hall. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
My story takes place in Squamish, BC. It is a climbing area just over the border in Canada. I was going there the first time in 2018 with my boyfriend Sheldon, and it was the first time he was meeting back up with his buddy who he hiked the PCT with, Skippy. When you drive into Squamish, it's breathtakingly stunning, and you come around a corner and the chief is just there. And it was our first time to Squamish. I mean, this place, the lore alone is, you know, in the community, it's the place to be. It's got thousands and thousands of boulder problems, and the forest itself is, it's very still. And so to be in a forest that just feels so old and established and untouched, I mean, the tree foliage is so high above you that it feels like you're stepping into a grand room where the tree trunks themselves are just pillars. And even if it's raining pretty heavily, you don't feel the rain as much. It's so dense. It's almost like a sound booth, you know, like sound does not move as far. And it's really easy to get lost. I mean, everything looks the same. It was our first night there. We were setting up our tents just outside of the forest. It's, you know, dusk time, not quite dinner yet. So we were like, let's just check out some rock before we've got to make dinner. We headed up the trail and then probably about a mile and a half turned left into the off trail into the forest. And we're just poking around, looking at interesting rocks, and you're just looking at everything. You're like, that's a boulder. That's a boulder. Like, I wonder if that's a boulder problem. Like, it's so overwhelming and easy to just like keep going from rock to rock to rock. And eventually we came across two boulders that were leaning up against each other, making this cave underneath them. We were all just like, wow. It just drew us in immediately to basically go check it out and see what's going on over here. So we got to the mouth of the cave, and we thought it was tall enough that you could even start a boulder problem within this cave and then climb out of it and then top it out on one of the sides of the cave. So we basically single filed into this cave looking for handholds. And we didn't have any headlights, any flashlights, anything like that. You know, there's enough light to see what we're seeing when we're outside of it. And we, you know, we're checking out the side thinking, oh, this is a cool rock, you know, look at these holds and all that stuff. And once we got back into it, probably about 10 feet, that's when, you know, the light starts to get dimmer, we're not able to see, and that's when we're like, wow, this is kind of deep too. So Sheldon gets out his flashlight on his phone and starts shining it on the wall, and all of our eyes fixate and lock in on this pool of light. We're probably about a foot or two away from the back of the cave at this point, and our eyes are fixated on this window of light that slowly pans to the back of the cave. As he does that, we all lock eyes with a girl. White dress, white skin, white hair. Just sitting there with her knees up to her chest and her arms around her knees, staring at us. our hearts dropped. And we don't say anything to each other. At least 3 seconds, I felt like me and her, we were looking at each other. And I don't know how to describe that feeling other than you're climbing a pitch and you just skip the last bolt and, you know, you're trying to clip this, you know, one that, you know, if you don't clip this next beaner, it's, you're going to take a whip. And like, that's the only time that I've like, my heart's like drop, like I'm about, I'm about to go for a ride. Before I know it, the light is gone. Sheldon has left us. First one out of the cave. And my instincts just kick in and we all take off running. We beeline it back to camp as fast as we can, sprinting through the Squamish Forest. I'm sure families are coming down off of the Chief from their lovely, you know, evening hikes. And we are like frantically sprinting past these people, you know, thinking that our, you know, nylon tents are safety at that point. And yeah, I'm sure we looked like complete crazy people to some visitors, but we all catch our breath and look at each other and are like, did you just see that? As we're sitting back at camp, eating our dinner, talking about this wild experience, we're trying to think of what this could possibly be and just rationalize it with each other. And, you know, Sheldon is just not one to believe in the paranormals or anything like that. I definitely think I'm more along the lines of someone to maybe believe in something like that as an option, but I took it upon myself to do as much research as possible to see, you know, was this a camper? Was this a climber? Was this, you know, is this something that happens here? Is this, you know, something that could be explained in any which way? But it wasn't warm. You know, this person was there with no materials, no supplies. Not even, we even tried to think of, you know, was that a reflective blanket we were looking at or something, like a heat blanket? And no, it was white. It was like bright white and just the most pale skin I have ever seen on a person. The more we dug into it, the less answers we had. We have been back to Squamish a couple of times, but we have never been back to the cave. I would be interested to see if we can find it again. There's a lot of rock out there. My name is Nicole, and this is my tale of terror.
I'm Brooke, and this is my tale of terror. So last year, I think it was last August, I had to go up to Washington for some personal stuff and was like, I'll make a climbing trip out of it. It'll be great. So I make my way up to Washington. My friend Maria and I were like, all right, well, we climbed up at Washington Pass for a day or two, had a good time together, and then we're like, cool, we could probably do something a little like bigger together. So we made plans to go into the Pickets. They're honestly one of the most like inspiring mountain ranges in Washington. Super jagged, pointy, and like they have decent glaciers and they're just alive, like a lot of rockfall, very loose. But yeah, they're notoriously kind of hard to get to. Most entrances to the pickets, there's different parts, the northern, the southern pickets, have some sort of bushwhack to some degree. You're like third classing up some like mud and like roots, trying to get up to these different cross-country zones. There's no defined trail to get there. And the pickets are known like orographically to kind of like suck in these weird weather systems as well. There's a number of people in Washington who've tried to pull off bigger objectives up there and have been skunked for years because they can't find a weather window. So they kind of have this allure to them. They're pretty wild mountains. I think they're like the most wild mountains, at least in like the Cascades, if not like fully glaciated ones in the lower 48. The names in the pickets are like Mount Fury and Challenger. It's kind of an ominously named place. So Marie and I were stoked to do some like moderate alpine rock climbing, so we set our eyes on the east ridge of Inspiration Peak. We kept pushing our plans back because the weather was saying it'd be sunny in 2 days, and then it was like pushed back another day, pushed back another day, and then we finally got a window. We were like, sweet, if we hike in with all of the gear, camp, climb in the morning, hike out, it'll be fine. So we were planning to spend one night at a cross-country camping zone called Terror Basin, and then do the approach across the glacier and climb the ridge and then come back down. We went to the Marble Mount Ranger Station and we asked about a permit, get a permit, get the lowdown, and they're like, there's a bear that's been out there. And we're like, we'll be fine, it's fine, we'll use a bear can, whatever. And then we get to the parking lot and there's like maybe two other cars there, and we're getting stoked to pack, like we're like trying to pack up the final bits of the group gear. And it just kind of feels like there's, even though like the forecast initially said that it was going to be sunny that day and sunny the next day, now it's saying it's going to be cloudy with a slight chance of rain that day, but sunny for sure the next day. And we're like, well, we might be going on like a skunk mission, but like we're just going to go anyways. And so we're like packing up and just like these clouds are kind of threatening, and it just felt a little like, I don't know, like unsettling. And Marie and I are tight. She's awesome. But I don't think, like, we hadn't gone on like a big objective like together. Like we had skied some stuff. So yeah, I think we both like didn't really acknowledge too much about it other than like, oh, this feels a little eerie, but like we're like, oh, there's no reason to feel anything other than stoke. And yeah, we started the hike in, and it was a mix of like the Cascade. Is it misting? Is it raining? Am I just this sweaty? So we were completely drenched by the time that we started the climb up towards like Terror Basin. We saw a group of three people hiking back out, but we didn't see anyone else on like the trail. We saw those folks like maybe 2 minutes in from the parking lot, and they were like, oh, we just climbed like West McMillan Spire. It's like a, you know, your average like Cascade, like I'm going mountaineering type of objective. And they were super stoked. And it was like, honestly, really nice to hear from them. But we were like, all right, we're going to carry on with our day. And the more we hiked in, we just got like, I don't know, it just felt like a little like weird, like ominous. But I was like, sweet, this is the pickets, this is what it is. You like go up through the trees on the climber's trail, it's like steep-ish. You're like fourth class over some roots, third class mud. Then you pop out on this alpine bench. And it was beautiful, but also like the clouds had totally socked it in. Like it was kind of raining the whole time. And there was like just like different bits of like rocks that were moving because you have to come down this like pretty loose like scree slope to get into the basin. So we kind of were both really happy when we got to camp, and we're like, sweet, like cool, we're here, we made it. And then we set up camp and we walked over towards the objective because we're like basically across a bench over to the glacier, and it's still decently far away. We're like, okay, maybe we want to scope out these granite slabs. And we go over there and we get full freaking service on the slabs next to it, to Inspiration Peak, which was weird for both of us, and we're like, what the heck? And then there was another group of two that was there that had the same objective as us, and they were like, oh, like you guys have service, like we don't have service, it's so strange. We're like, okay, this is just all weird. We checked the weather, chance of like the lightning storms like the morning. We're like, sweet, cool, we'll just see what happens. So then we go to bed and we set our alarms to wake up the next day. Thank you. Day two, we wake up. I didn't sleep super well, but that's not anything strange. I think everyone gets, or like everyone who climbs in the mountains a decent amount, like probably at some point has felt the pre-climb like anxiety of like, oh, I'm going to go climb the thing tomorrow. I wonder how it's going to go. And I think that's healthy, but there's something off. Like it wasn't just that. And I didn't really know what. And we like look over there and there's clouds and they look like thunderclouds. Maria was like, what if we just went on a walk? And I was like, I just like see there's a thunderhead like directly over the mountain that we're going to go, that we're aiming to go climb. And it totally could have passed. But I was the one who was like, you know what? I don't feel great about like, because it's like kind of a committing route. And it's like a, just like a long, not super complicated, but just like involved like descent. And we hadn't crossed the glacier, even though it looked in decent shape. And I just was like, eh, just like my intuition told me no. And so I was like, no. And Maria's awesome. And she's like, okay. And we like slept in, ate some food, and like hiked back out in the rain. It didn't like storm on us, but I can't speak for my partner, but for me, I definitely felt just a little like unsettled hiking out of the mountains and down the path that we went. Maybe I felt unsettled because I hate bailing. Who doesn't hate bailing? But also I just felt like, I don't know, the mountains were like saying no. And just if you've ever seen the, like the skyline of the Pickets, pretty imposing and like, I don't know, they have a lot of character, but also instills like a healthy amount of like, I respect you and like you're saying no right now, and so I'm gonna give myself wider margins later. Yeah, we get back to the car and Marie and I like split up our gear from our bags, and I was like, all right, well, have fun, it was really nice to hang, like it was nice to see you again, and we went our separate ways. And then I went up to Washington Pass for a couple days, and I come back down into service after climbing up there with my friend Hannah and check my, I had voicemail, and I hate voicemail and I never check it, but that also led to me having a full voicemail box. So I was like, fine, I'll listen to this. Like, who called me and left me a voicemail? And it was a message from a law enforcement ranger based out of the North Cascades. The law enforcement ranger was asking if I had seen anyone that fit, like a young male that was hiking out. And he had a pretty almost identical itinerary like to ours, and he had the exact same dates. So he would have been hiking out of the Goodell Creek trailhead the day that we were hiking out. He would have been coming out those same days. And he had apparently gone missing. And they had the aviation crew on it doing searches from the air. They had ground teams, and they couldn't find a trace of him. They had no idea. And so he was like, if you have any information or you saw him on your way in or your way out, like we love any kind of help. And I was like, whoa, weird. Like we didn't see a freaking soul the whole time other than those folks who were already in camp and had gotten there quite a bit earlier than us. Yeah, I just felt me. I was like, ugh. Just like one of those icky feelings that you can't really put a finger on why you feel that way. I just was like, oh, that's like kind of, I don't know, spooky. So went on with my life, talked to Maria maybe a few days afterwards, and she was like, oh, like they had called me too, but she was in service when they called, and she's like, yeah, like so weird, like so strange. And I was like, oh God, is that what was going on when I was out there? Like, where was this guy? Where is this guy? It just like the North Cascades, I feel like, has swallowed up more than a couple of people. And it's so wet and moist and like just poof into thin air.
After the break, more unexplained phenomenon.
Calling all business owners out there.
Yeah, I'm talking to you. Our planet needs businesses to be better. Newsflash, right? There's a way we do that. One of the moments in our journey as a company that Becca and I are most proud of is the day we joined 1% for the Planet 14 years ago. We know we have an impact. It's undeniable, right? It's not someone else's problem. It's our problem. And we wanted to become a part of a global network of individuals, businesses, and environmental not-for-profits driving real impact. So every year there's a day where we sit down and we plan our giving. It starts with a donation, but we've been able to bolster that with in-kind donations. There's all sorts of ways to do this. Other companies give employee volunteer time, so there's a solution that's right for you. The biggest thing is it connects us with others who care and organizations going to bat for the values we believe in. And it makes us feel part of something bigger than our small company. So if you're a business owner, big or small, publicly traded or not, there's room for you in this movement. Visit 1percentfortheplanet.org/dirtbagdiaries for more information. Be a part of this. We may have more than one career, but there is only one planet. 1% for the planet.
I'm Michael, and this is my tale of terror. So in March of this year, I was running the Home Quarry 40 Miler, which is a pretty cool race that happens every year. That's in the George Washington National Forest. It's very beautiful, some really good ridge traversing. And as part of trying to make ultra running, which is a completely selfish pursuit, more family oriented, I've tried to drag my family along. So on this occasion, we'd rented a cabin somewhere on the race area down one of the sort of the darker hollows, it turns out. And getting a family of two kids and my wife and the dog in the car and traveling a couple hours west of Washington, D.C., where we live, is always fun. We'd arrived, we'd unpacked. It was in the middle of a sort of rainstorm because right before you do an ultra, it's got to rain a lot to make sure it's nice and muddy for you. And it was a really nice cold rain in March. And so it's just on this tarmac road. It's a little cabin. Very tight quarters, but quite lovely. The kids were arguing over who got the top bunk and the bottom bunk. We'd made dinner. We'd got everybody sort of semi-settled down. In the back of my mind, I'm a little bit nervous because we've got, I got to wake up 4:30 to make sure I'm there for the start of the race and check in the next morning. So trying to get everybody into a rhythm, into a little bit of peace, I get everybody down. I take the dog out for a walk. So I've got a German Shepherd Husky mix, which is, a medium-sized dog. Usually not afraid of very much, but as soon as we open the door, it's sort of raining and it's dark. And if you're like me and you live in a city but you recreate out in the woods, you forget that there's urban darkness and then there's non-urban darkness. So I open the door and get out, and I realize that it's gone dark, and I can see the light on the porch behind me. And I can see the light about 300 meters down the road for the next house that's there. And I sort of make a decision of like, you know what? I don't really need to go back and get my head torch. I don't want to use the batteries in case it runs out for tomorrow. So I'll just walk down this road. I'm not going to get lost. I'm not going to fall in a ditch. This will be really easy. So dog and I start walking. There's trees on the right-hand side that goes up on a hill, on a slope, and then it drops away on the left-hand side into the stream. So you can hear the stream noises, you can hear the water dripping from the trees, you can hear it's still raining a little bit, but it's really quiet. And about, I want to say, it wasn't very long, it was probably a couple of minutes, so maybe 100 meters down this road, I sort of see out of the corner of my eye on the right-hand side, about 30 meters up the hill, that there is that there's something white. And so I look over because I think it's a gas tank or something like that, and there's nothing there. And so my brain starts filling in. So every time I look at the road, I can see this thing in white, it's on the side, and my brain fills in, and it tells me that there's this person who's standing there, and it's a guy in white with white scraggly beard, but he was just sort of standing there watching. So this guy's standing on the right-hand side, and I keep trying to look directly at him, and every time I look directly at him, I can't see him. But every time I look away, my brain keeps registering that there's something on the hillside up on the right. So your brain's playing tricks on you, whatever. That's okay. So I keep walking, and I look down at the dog, and the dog, who is not afraid of very much, is whimpering, and his ears are back and his tail is down between his legs. He was looking around trying to figure out where the danger was coming from, and it raised the hair on the back of my neck a little bit. And so I'm thinking, maybe I need to cut this short a little bit. So I walk, keep on walking, He does his business, which means I can turn around and very courageously speed walk back into the house. And so as I get back into the house, I don't bother looking over my shoulder. I just, you know, open the door, chuck the dog in, I jump in, close the door, stand there just a little bit to get a hold of myself because, you know, I've dragged my wife and my two kids out to this remote cabin. I don't want to tell them that I'm kind of freaked out by something. So I just, you know, take it, don't mention it, don't say anything about it, take a deep breath, and then go about the process, which is getting two younger children to go to bed in a strange house on short notice. So my daughter was falling asleep on her feet, but insisting she wasn't tired, had to get lifted into the upstairs bunk. My son was insisting he needed to read for another half an hour. There was a pile of dishes that needed doing. Checked and rechecked everything, laid shoes out by the door, then decided to put them on the table because I was worried the dog was going to chew on them in the night, and talked to my wife, you know, all of that stuff. And then lay down and thought, the bed's lumpy, I hope it doesn't mess up my back for tomorrow. My biggest worry was that I wasn't going to sleep early enough in order to make up for the loss of sleep waking up super early so that I was in good shape to run the next day. And I wasn't super worried about something that my brain had told me was there that clearly couldn't be there, shouldn't be there. You know, it's unlikely that a man, an elderly man in white, would be standing in the trees watching down on me. And so I just thought, eh, no problem. And, you know, just go to sleep, and it starts raining. So, you know, it's, you know, intermittent raining, the roof's a, you know, zinc or tin or something, so it makes a lot of noise. And I go to sleep, and then the next thing I know, my daughter is standing over me. Dada. Dada, I had a bad dream. Can I come in with you guys? The drill is, I sit up, I go with her, I lie down with her, I talk to her about it. And so I'm sort of, you know, I've got this child in this strange bunk bed. We crawl up into the top. There's about 3 inches of space between the top bunk and the ceiling. And so it's kind of this little squeeze space. So it's perfect for a little 8-year-old girl to crawl into. It's very hard for bigger me to get into. So when I took her back to bed, I picked her up, I slid her in there, put her under the covers, and then I had to sort of squirm into this thing. So we're lying down in this coffin, and she's sort of like, oh, I had a nightmare. And so I'm like, okay, you know, normal drill. She's tucked into my arm. I'm like, okay, honey, why don't you tell me a little bit about, you know, why don't you tell me about your nightmare? And she says, yeah, Dada, I had a dream. There's a guy, there's a man in white, and he has a star in his chest. And he's standing outside the door because he wants to kill you. And I immediately am completely and utterly wide awake. And so I go, well, you know, honey, don't worry, it's just a dream. And so I sort of sit there thinking about how soon can I get out of this bed, because I'm going to go and I'm going to up. You do not invade my daughter's dreams. This is not okay. So I'm sort of laying there very quietly doing my important dad thing and not alarming anybody else. And then so she goes to sleep. I slide out of the bed, make sure that she's not waking up. I look around the house to make sure everybody's asleep and quiet. And then I go into the kitchen and I get open the salt shaker, get salt in my left hand, and get the biggest knife out of the butcher block in my right hand, turn the doorknob, and step out into the rain and the darkness. And I'm just sort of sitting there under the awning, and the sound of the rain hitting the thing, saying, you know, okay, come on, let's do this. If this is what you want, let's go. Stood there for a couple minutes, nothing happened, so it's all right. You know, closed the door, locked it, went back, you know, lay down. And I went to sleep in another 2 or 3 minutes. But all night, something was banging on the roof trying to get in. And so when I woke up in the morning, I said, you know, my wife's like, hey, did you hear that? All night, something was like scratching on the roof, and something was banging on the roof and scratching on the doors. And like, you didn't hear that at all? And I was like, no, absolutely not. And got up and went and ran my 40 miles and came back and absolutely never mentioned it to anybody.
Thank you, Nicole, Brooke, and Michael, for terrorizing me. Seriously. Come on. That is a year's worth of bad dreams there. Thanks for that. Anyway, music today from Kai Engel, Aiden Baker, and David Beard. The tracks are courtesy of Artists or Free Music Archive. Jacob Bain and Nice Koto composed our theme song. You can find the links to the artists at our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. This episode was produced by Andrew Burton, Lauren Delaney Miller, Ashley Langholtz, Becca Call, and me, Fitz Cahal. Team effort. So much fun. Thank you everyone for contributing. Illustration by Walker Call. Becca Call is our executive producer. I'm Fitz, and you've been listening to Dirtbag Diaries. Thanks for tuning in. And happy Halloween!